I did want to just say again, in case you missed it, the way I'm wired, I don't like to run by someone, and I enjoy the connecting time after church, but that won't be happening today. Katie and I have a very tight time frame. When I realized the time that she had to be there, I was like, oh, that's going to be interesting. But today we're going to be looking at, we're continuing in Genesis, but we're kind of, again, a series within the series. We're moving from Abraham. Isaac just gets a little blip. He got 1 week last week, and he really even wasn't the star of that chapter even. But today we're going to be starting about a 4 or 5 week series with Jacob. This is some of my favorite parts of Scripture. I don't know if it's because Jacob was a family name. Jacob Ward McCracken was my grandfather, and I fought wanting to name one of our kids Jacob, but I lost that battle. Bryce and Katie, you can be grateful. Jacob is just the meaning of the name didn't go over well with Jana. So, and we'll get to that. It's not a real flattering name. There's a reason that Jacob's name has changed, and his character, which signifies not only God's hand in Jacob's life, but the change in his life as well. But you know, as I was thinking, we're going to be looking today at the account of Jacob and his twin brother Esau's birth in Genesis 25, verses 19 and following. And as we look at that, I just want me to think. I mean, we all tend to have accounts of our birth. Of course, we don't remember that. Things I know that evidently because my mom told me 100 times there was a blizzard on the day I was born. I know Bryce, when he was born, interrupted Monday Night Football. Actually, Jana's water breaking interrupted Monday Night Football. And then they induced around 1 o'clock at McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh around 1. And Jana was in labor with Bryce all day until about 10 o'clock that night when he was finally brought out by C-section, was born with a bruise on his head. And Jan always got upset when then people say, oh, you had a C-section. You didn't have to go through labor. It was like, oh, no, she went through an entire day of labor before he was born. Katie, I remember, very different story. It seemed like forever before Bryce finally came. Katie, we left the house at 7 a.m., and she was here by noon, which I, you know, in some ways, I can see some personality differences there, too. But in looking at the differences in their birth, I don't know, that might be making too much of it, but... But in the scriptures, when often there are accounts in the scriptures where it's talking about the birth of a child, or even sometimes in some of the angelic visits, both in the Old and New Testament, when a child's birth was going to be announced, we get a little glimpse into their character, and we see that in this. And really, it seems kind of odd. Like when this is one of those passages you look at it and say, "Oh, maybe I should just skip that, get on to some of the meatier passages." And yet, I really felt like looking at the account of their birth, Jacob's birth, really gives us a picture of some of the key themes that are going to carry us through the next few weeks. So I just want to encourage you. That's really where we're at today. It's going to be a brief reflection on these verses, chapter 25, verses 19 through 28. We're going to be reflecting on the account, which is kind of an interesting account. Well, it's not being kind of. It's a strange account. And one that probably the doctors, if this happened today, the doctors and nurses would be talking about it. But we're going to look at that, and we're going to reflect on what I think are three themes you can see in this that kind of point us to the three critical themes throughout the Jacob story. But let's go ahead and read verses 19 through 28, and I'll stop occasionally, just make some comments. Verse 19, it says, "These are the generations of Isaac." And again, I mentioned, Isaac gets shortchanged. If you read through Genesis... It's a ton on Abraham, a lot on Jacob, and then Joseph, but very little on Isaac. But he's in that sequence of God's chosen, the one God chose that through Abraham and then through Isaac and then through Jacob would be God's chosen people. "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren." If you've been with us through Genesis, that's a pretty consistent theme. throughout Genesis, the idea of barrenness and God having to intervene. It says Isaac prayed for the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah his wife conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" And so she went to inquire of the Lord. Some of the commentaries and some of the translations reflect this, basically say that her comment of why is this happening to me is not just trying to figure out, like mothers do today when you seem to, I mean, I have women, you can correct me, but I always hear that if you have a lot more acid reflux, the child is probably going to be born with more hair. Is that accurate? Okay. I don't know. I'm clueless on those things, but you know, sometimes mothers wonder, well, what's going on? I mean, something's happening and they're wondering what's going on with the pregnancy. And, she's got World War III going on within her. And she's like, it's not just the what's happening. Some commentators have actually said that the translation of this more accurately is, I'm done. I can't do this. Like, it'd be better for me not to live than to be going through what I'm going through right now. So, I mean, this is a very uncomfortable part of her pregnancy, as this conflict is already starting in the womb between Jacob and Esau. But it says at the end of that verse, verse 22, it says, so she went to inquire of the Lord. She's praying. She's going to God to pray and ask, what's going on? So verse 23, it says, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. And when her days were to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now think of it. At this point, she's got this message, this prophetic message from the Lord, of talking about not only two children, but two nations within her. But until the actual birth of Jacob and Esau, there's no confirmation of twins. And so God has given us that clue that there's more than one child here. But we see in this account, it's not just Jacob. It's Jacob and Esau being born. And again, this is where the passage gets weird. At least most parents don't typically would describe their kids in those first few moments in this way. So the descriptions are giving us a picture of who Jacob and Esau really are. But we unpack that over the next few weeks. But it says, verse 25, the first came out red, all of his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Esau. Now, there's some thought, they don't know if he's red because his skin complexion was red, or he was so covered with hair that it was red hair. What was interesting is that culturally, even like sometimes today, redhead people with red hair sometimes can be celebrated, often are derided for that red hair. I'm thinking Anne of Green Gables and some other stories that it's like culturally can be something that people look at as a negative. In the ancient world, it was definitely viewed negatively. So it was this account in saying that he's not only covered with hair, but he's red. This is not painting Esau in a very positive light, even in these few words. Verse 26 goes on. We see Esau is born. It says, but afterward, it says, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. Now, one thing that I think we miss today, if someone has twins, you may hear twins joke about who's older. I've heard twins that they argue and say, well, you're just older than me. And later in life, and it seems like when they're younger, they want to be the older one. But then when they get older, they argue about which one's the youngest. But in the ancient world, that birth order, especially for men, was critical. Because if you were the firstborn, you got the whole enchilada. You got everything. I mean, you would get the father's blessing. You'd be in line to inherit everything the father has. And there's significance to that we don't really understand in our culture. But what we see in this is this idea, this image of Esau coming out and this heel or hand being grabbed onto Esau's heel. from birth, Jacob and Esau are in conflict. They're fighting for position. Fighting for position of who would be born first, and then later, when that's all sorted out, as they grow older and we see the different accounts, they're fighting over the father's blessing. They're fighting over their birthrights. And that started even in this account, of saying that struggle started even within the womb. Verse 27 begins to give us a little bit of how the boys grew. It says, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, and I think survivalist. Kind of picture the idea of, we have a lot of guys here that are, I'm not trying to negatively paint you, but we would celebrate. In our culture, we'd celebrate this guy. Esau would be the guy in Warren that we're like, man, did you see Esau? Did you see the buck that he got last year? That man knows the woods. He knows the land. Says that Esau, again, he's a skillful hunter, man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Now, how many of you men want to be labeled with do you want to be the skillful hunter or the man dwelling in tents? No one's going to be honest. Actually, there's other accounts throughout Genesis, some of which we've already looked at, that describe Abraham and Isaac and the patriarchs as being, they dwelt in tents. They were not only possessing the land that God had given them, but they were described as men who dwelt in tents. And so this is giving even a clue, not only of Jacob's character, that he's in the tents probably helping his mom and caring for the household, but it's giving us that picture already of Jacob more in line with who Abraham and Isaac were. It says in verse 28, it says, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of the game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, I know those of you with multiple children or if you had multiple siblings, the great debate is always, do parents have favorites? I know my mom would always tell me I was her favorite son. I'm the only son. We joke about those things, and yet that's often a point of contention and tension in families, that if a child perceives that there's a favorite. And so right here from the beginning of the account, this is a divided home. Isaac loves Esau. Because he loves a son who's the hunter, bringing him back game to eat. But it just says simply that Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, all of that introduces us to what's going to come in the coming weeks. And Steve and Jim are going to be helping with that as we unpack Jacob and really look at this. But there are three words that I want, if you remember anything else today, as you go out, hopefully the words will help you remember what we talked about. But there are three words that I think are critical in the sense of a theme. Not only that we kind of see here, but that when we take today's passage in light of all of Jacob's account and the story, I think there are three key words and key themes for us to be thinking about. And that's struggle. I mean, that's beyond anything. You see, even in Jacob's name, the idea of struggle. I mean, we have an account later. He's wrestling with an angel of the Lord. His whole life is described in the sense of struggle. And we're also going to look and reflect, and it may not be a word that's used directly, but when you reflect on what happens, even in this account, and even as other passages like Malachi and in the New Testament reflect on Jacob and Esau, there's also another key theme of being God's chosen. What's the significance of God choosing Jacob and not choosing Esau? So you have the struggle, you have God choosing, and then you also have the issue of transformation. And again, it builds to that place. We don't see it in this passage, but I believe that one of the key aspects of understanding how God could take a man like Jacob and use him when he really is not painted in positive light at all. I mean, he really comes across as a real scoundrel in many ways. He's true to his name. we see, when you look at the whole story, you see that not only did God choose him, but God transforms him. And so I want us to keep those things in mind. And if you're going to take the challenge over the next few weeks to be reading ahead and reading through the passages and reflecting on it, I encourage you to do that in your own Bible reading. But be thinking about those themes. Look at Jacob's struggle and say, how does that inform me in the struggle in living the Christian life? Look at the fact that Jacob is one that God has chosen, and that he is the chosen one of the two brothers. What does it really mean to be chosen? And I'm going to tell you in advance, avoid the theological arguments on that one. Because I think what often happens, and we'll unpack that a little bit, we get so caught up in the arguments of God's choosing and not choosing another that we miss the significance of what it means to celebrate the fact that we have been chosen by God. But then also that theme of transformation. Hopefully you can look at Jacob and say, you know, if God can use Jacob, surely he can use me. And God can do a work in your heart and your life to transform you. But look, think at first for this struggle. Going back to those verses we read, it says that the children struggled within her. And the account goes on to give us a picture of Jacob struggling with Esau. He basically tricks, and once even with the help of his mom, tricks his brother. Now we get that. Brothers like to pull pranks on each other. These are not just pranks. What we see coming up in the weeks ahead is Jacob being deceptive to take what by his birthright of a few minutes, if that, was due to Esau. His birthright, and then later his father's blessing, you see this deception come out, and it gives us a picture of Jacob, that same Jacob who's holding on to Esau's heel in wrestling and struggling and striving throughout life. We see it again and again and again throughout his story that he's living this life of struggle, this constant striving. We see literally later he wrestling with an angel of the Lord, and we'll unpack that in the weeks. I think that's Steve's week, right, Steve? I think. But we're going to look at the fact that he actually wrestles with an angelic being, or wrestles with the divine, and even the name change reflects that theme. So Jacob is a picture of that. His whole life is described with struggle, and I think when we look in our own lives, we can identify with that. Our culture is so focused on competition and getting ahead that we live in a culture that we should identify with this idea of constant struggle. And the scary thing is, I think culturally, that influences us in a way that sometimes we take that cultural issue and we supplant it onto the way that we walk with God. And the way that we're going to walk in relationship with God, because we're going to keep trying to strive. We're going to try to get ahead and somehow manage it and manipulate it our own. Years ago, some of you, I know, familiar with a group called Sun Life. When I first worked in youth ministry, they were the group that was training most of the people in the Alliance to work with youth. Steve, you probably went through that, I think. But I remember one of the things that they had a principle, and I can't remember what they called the principle, but it basically was something like this. The Christian life is simple, and the Christian life is impossible. Those two things seem contradictory, and yet they're both true when you think about it. We sometimes overcomplicate the Christian message. And we have to remember the simple message that the Father sent the Son, who died in our place, took our sin upon himself, so that we might be forgiven and restored to relationship with God, our Creator. That's simple. Seems simple. There's a lot of theology you can unpack, but we tend to muddy that up sometimes. That God calls us through Christ, and we come to recognize what Jesus has done for us, and we surrender our lives to him. We're just walking with Jesus, our Savior. But there's also an aspect of that other phrase, the Christian life is simple. It's all about Jesus, walking with Jesus. But the Christian life is also impossible. And when you look at the theme of struggle throughout the Old and New Testament, and I'm thinking of Romans 7 and Paul's struggle, with not being able to do the things he wants to do and doing all the things he doesn't want to do, and who's going to deliver me from this body of death? We get to chapter 8 and it says, "Now there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus." The struggle ends when we realize it's not us. It's not us striving. It's not us working harder. It's us coming to a point of surrender in our lives that God is able to work in us and through us. Where we stop striving and we let God do that work. So both of those principles, years ago when I heard that, it rang true to me. It is simple. We need to be careful that we keep the message of the gospel clear and simple. But we also need to tell people living this life is impossible on your own. You can't live this life. The life that Christ calls us to, we can't live apart from God's Spirit coming inside of us and empowering us to live the life that he calls us to. And so when we reflect on Jacob, that may have seemed like a big leap, but with this theme of struggle, we see this. We see in Jacob, he's striving, he's working so hard to try to get ahead and to try to earn God's favor, to earn the Father's blessing. In the Christian life, if you're looking at the Christian life and saying, I just got to work harder. I'm not having a successful Christian life, and I just got to work harder. I'm always nervous that if you walk out of here after hearing me or anyone else preaching, if you walk out of here and saying, okay, Sunday afternoon, Monday morning, I just got to work harder this week. If there are times we all need a kick in the pants when it comes to teaching and preaching. We all need that. But if the challenge comes without the promise of empowerment, I've failed you, or whoever has been here teaching has failed you. Because while we have to engage, we have to be surrendered and fully committed, we need to understand that to really live the life that God calls us to, we have to let him fight those battles. We have to let him do his work inside of us. We need to be surrendered so God's Spirit can fill us and so he can use us. I'm amazed when you reflect on Jacob. I'm a little jealous Steve is going to preach this chapter, I think. But when he gets to one of the he has two evenings where God meets him. And he has this encounter with God, and he basically afterwards realizes, he sets up a memorial, and he realizes that he had missed God's presence. He missed the fact that God was there. And this is more than just this idea of statement of saying, well, God is omnipresent. He's everywhere. I firmly believe that Jacob is so caught up in the struggle and the striving, the scheming, the conniving. He's so caught up in all those things of who he is and what he's trying to accomplish that he misses God's presence. And that brings us to Psalm 46:10, just as a thought with regard to struggle. Again, this is all introductory today. But when we think about the struggle when it comes to the Christian life or walking in relationship with God, we need to remember Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. And again, that be still can literally be translated, cease striving. Stop striving. Stop striving and know that I am God. We have to come into a place in our walk with God where we recognize we can't do this on our own. We need to be surrendered and let God do that work in us and through us. Our job is passive in the sense of it's active in the sense we have to choose to be willing to surrender, but it's passive then that once we've surrendered, we let God work and we let God lead in our lives. Second theme. Not only do we see Jacob throughout this account and throughout his story as one who's struggling in this constant struggle and he needs and the need to come to a place of recognizing God's working in his life, but we also see the issue of choice, that God has chosen Jacob. This is actually reflected later in Malachi 1, 2 through 3 and Romans 9, 10 through 13, and we don't have time to unpack all that. But the same phrase, Paul later in Romans quotes almost verbatim from Malachi 1 and uses this phrase in saying, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. Now, in the context and what that is saying, that this is not focusing on emotion in the way that we would say I love or hate someone. The context, they're talking about Israel's election, the fact that God chose Israel in comparison to the other nations of the world. And later, Paul's struggling with this issue of saying, well, now that we've come to this place that we're not saved by being part of Israel, we're saved by putting our faith in Jesus Christ. He's in Romans 9 and those few chapters there, he's dealing with this question, what about Israel? We thought Israel were the chosen ones. What does this mean? And what's interesting is Paul quotes from Malachi and actually uses this idea of election for Israel, uses it as in his argument to say it's not based on birth. It's not based on nationality. And you look at the whole story of Romans, we know that it's based on faith in Jesus Christ. This idea, though, of the Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, you could very accurately say and translate that of Jacob I chose, Esau I didn't choose. Now, theologians, we tend to get caught up there. Theologians get caught up in this, and I've known lots of people that like the theological debates and arguments that try to put divine sovereignty and God's choosing and free will at odds against each other. I spent 8 years in an institution that was on the free will side, and I'm pretty much in that direction. And I know that I believe in divine sovereignty, but I also believe God has given us a free will. And there is a great mystery in how all that plays out. But I want to say this. If we get caught up in the theological arguments about what it means to be predestined or chosen by God, and we miss the point of each of those passages, the point is consistently not only lifting God up above his creation, but is highlighting the fact that when we are chosen, it's highlighting the significance of that fact. The emphasis isn't as much towards Esau here as much as it is that God chose Jacob. And there's great significance for every one of us. When we celebrate the fact that when we have come to faith in Christ, we know that God has had his hand on us. He's called us by name. We are chosen by him. And so I avoid the theological arguments the best that I can, because I think both of them have a key part of the answer. God is sovereign, and there's a mystery in his will. But I firmly believe we have to come to a place in our life that we celebrate. If we're walking with God, remember this is a key theme to the whole of Genesis account that we're studying. We're talking about walking with God. We need to live in a way that we celebrate the fact that God chose us, that we are his chosen ones, and live in that celebration. Some of the passages that speak to that, Ephesians 1, 3 through 6 says, blessed be the God of our Father, of the Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places, even as he chose us in him before the foundation, just totally lost my notes, that we should be holy and blameless before him. In love, he predestined us for adoption to himself as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace, with which he has blessed us in the beloved. Now, I've had the joy of walking with friends through the adoption process, and to know the joy. There's joy when you have a biological child coming into your family. It changes everything. It's a great joy. There is a special joy when you're walking with a family when they have chosen to adopt a child. And the words that stand out at the end of verse 4 and going into verse 5, it says, in love, he predestined. In love, he predestined. In love, predestined means he chose. In love, he chose. He chose us for the adoption to himself as sons. He brought us into his family. Years ago, one of the life conferences, the youth conferences, we'll have one coming up next year. The Alliance typically has had kind of a run with speakers. Like for a while, it was Francis Chan in recent years that was there every couple years. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a guy that spoke. His name was Dave Busby. Anyone ever hear Dave Busby? If you heard him, you would remember. Not because he was a great athlete or anything. Dave was actually someone who was very frail. From his childhood, he fought health condition after health condition. He fought cystic fibrosis, polio, liver disease, heart disease, diabetes. I believe he was only functioning with one lung. And yet this guy was, he was a booming preacher. And I remember him telling the story because he was dealing with all that as a kid, and he looked up to his brother who loved him and really kind of looked after him. And he was in that dreaded position that every boy and most every girl has experienced in phys ed, where they line everyone up to pick teams to play basketball. And Dave's brother was a great basketball player, and he was one of the two captains picking teams. And when it came down to making the choices, his brother went down the line before hardly anyone else had been chosen, and his hand stopped at Dave and says, "Dave, I choose you." Dave wasn't worried about all the people that weren't chosen that may have been more deserving. What he heard in that moment, what he conveyed that I still remember 20 years later hearing the message, is his brother loved him, and his brother chose him, and he chose him to be a part of that team. The scriptures are clear that when we're chosen, it's God putting his hand on our lives, and he's chosen us not just to express his love and his grace and his care, because none of us are deserving of it, but that we also remember that we are chosen for a purpose. We are chosen for a purpose to become like Christ, to be holy, to make Christ known. And that leads us to the third theme. One of the ways that God makes himself known in us is he changes us. He transforms us, and we begin to reflect him to the world. And again, most of the Jacob story, we look, and Jacob is really not painted in positive light. He meets Laban, who they share the similar characteristics of kind of treachery and deception, and you see kind of a mirror of each other, and then God begins to do a work in Jacob's heart, and there's a transformation that takes place, and Jacob actually experiences the name change, that Jacob becomes Israel. Jacob, literally meaning the heel, from the birth scene, he's holding onto the heel, or the deceiver, becomes Israel. And there's different understandings of what that means, but some have said it means prevailed with God, or that God strives, or God perseveres. But the thing that can't be missed is there's a change. God gives Jacob a new name. And the name was significant of character. There's a character change that takes place. And Jacob, from this encounter, actually walks away with a limp. And through this encounter, and if you want to understand that, you got to come back that week. But he's changed from this encounter. And so where if you're here today and you're hearing this idea of the striving, you're hearing the idea of God choosing, I hope that you look at the idea of Jacob and say, look, if God can use Jacob, the scoundrel, he can use me. And he's going to do that by not only putting his hand on us and choosing us to walk with us, to give us the higher purpose in our life, but he's going to then empower us through transforming us. Romans 8:29 is such a key verse with this. It says, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among the many brothers." Key phrase, those he predestined or chose, those he chose to be conformed to the image of his Son. They were chosen to become like the Son, to be formed and shaped, to become like Jesus. Over the next few weeks, as you reflect on the scriptures and as we walk through these scriptures together, I want us to keep these themes in mind, not only the themes we looked at today, but last week, as we looked at Isaac and Rebekah and the theme of steadfast love and God's steadfast love toward us. But let's remember the struggle and ask ourselves, are we struggling or are we resting in God? Are we struggling or are we trusting God? Are we celebrating the theme of being chosen by God? I mean, it should be something we celebrate daily, the fact that we are God's child. If we've received Him, we've become His child. Let's celebrate that fact. Let's celebrate that choice that God has chosen us. And remember that we are chosen for a purpose, to become like Him and to be a witness for Him. And that in doing that, God is going to do a work in our hearts and transform us. And we know that the work that He begins in us, He's going to do the work, and He's going to finish that work until the day that He comes for us. Philippians 1:6 says, "And I am sure of this, that He who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." Will you pray with me as the worship team comes?
You please stand as we sing.